Well, this is the sixth message on the life of Joseph and the third one in a three part on responsibility. And this will be the last one on that. The title is Responsibility, Part 3. We looked at Joseph's response to slavery when he was sold by his brothers. We looked at his response to seduction by Potiphar's wife the last time we met. And we're going to look at his response to yet another setback tonight as we look at his life. God is forming a character in Joseph in all of these situations. And folks, God is forming a character in us. In every pressure, every trial, every temptation he brings into our lives every day. Now, there's a lot more involved in it with the Spirit of God working in our heart, and I'm not discounting any of that, but from a purely human level, it's kind of like a checkbook. You make withdrawals and you make deposits, and your balance determines whether you put in more money than you've taken out. And every time you and I make a decision that is disobedient to God, we destroy our character. And every time we make a decision that honors God, we build it. And the goal is to get into a position where we're making a lot of right decisions. And that's where Joseph is. And you teenagers, I exhort you, those of you who are teenagers and younger and college students especially, this is not a time of life to drift. You are making decisions right now by the kinds of friends you choose. That is a choice. It's a decision. By the things you listen to when you are around those friends and the kinds of things you talk about, you are destroying your character or building it. And I tell the freshmen over at the university in orientation that right now, as freshmen, you are determining the kind of teenagers you will have. And that seems kind of remote, but when you stop and think about it, you are right now a certain kind of person. And you will attract a certain kind of person based on the kind of person you are. And if you are a mediocre, lukewarm Christian, you will attract a mediocre, lukewarm person to marry you. And you will have a mediocre, lukewarm life with your spouse and raise mediocre or worse children. And you finally will wake up when your teenagers are going bad and saying, "What on earth went wrong?" And maybe you'll start getting serious with God. You don't have to wait that long. You are determining right now the kind of teenagers you are going to have while you are a teenager yourself. This is not a time to mess around. This is a time to do right every chance you have to do right. And we see that happening in Joseph's life. God is forming a character in him. Let's read for our text tonight, Genesis 39, verse 21. We'll read to the end of chapter 40. Remember, Joseph is now in prison as a result of Potiphar's wife's accusations. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Interesting, God never sent Joseph to prison. He went with him, didn't he? Verse 22, and the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did the Lord made to prosper. Chapter 40. And it came to pass after these things that the butler of the king of Egypt and his baker had offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was wroth against the two of his officers, against the chief of the butlers, against the chief of the bakers, the chief of the candlestick makers. Oh, no, that's not in there, is it? And he put them in ward in the house of the captain of the guard. Now, who's the captain of the guard? That's Potiphar. This is a different prison than Joseph was in initially. Joseph was put in a common prison. Psalm 105 says that he was hurt. His feet were hurt in irons and his neck was put in iron. That's when he's originally imprisoned here. But then he finds favor in the eyes of the prison keeper and eventually is put in what was called the roundhouse. This was where the royal prisoners were kept, and Joseph is now elevated to now work directly under Potiphar again, keeping the royal prisoners. That's what's happening in chapter 40. Verse 3. And he put them, that's the chief of the butlers and the chief of the bakers, in ward in the house of the captain of the guard, that's Potiphar, into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them, and they continued a season in ward. And they dreamed a dream, both of them, each man his dream in one night, each man according to the interpretation of his dream, the butler and baker of the king of Egypt, which were bound in the prison. And Joseph came in unto them in the morning and looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. And he asked Pharaoh's officers that were with him in the ward of his Lord's house, saying, "Wherefore look ye so sadly today?" And they said unto him, "We've dreamed a dream, and there's no interpreter of it." And Joseph said unto them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me them, I pray you." And the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream, behold, a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches, and it was as though it budded, and her blossom shot forth, and the clusters thereof brought forth ripe grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said unto him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thine head and restore thee unto thy place, and thou shalt deliver Pharaoh's cup into his hand after the former manner when thou wast his butler. But think on me when it shall be well with thee, and show kindness, I pray thee, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also have I done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon." When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said unto Joseph, "I also was in my dream, and behold, I had 3 white baskets on my head. And in the uppermost basket there was all manner of baked meats for Pharaoh, and the birds did eat them out of the basket upon my head." And Joseph answered and said, "This is the interpretation thereof. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thy head from off thee, and shall hang thee on a tree, and the birds shall eat thy flesh from off thee." And it came to pass the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast unto all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants, and he restored the chief butler unto his butlership again, and he gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted them. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. Father in heaven, we thank you for your marvelous providence in our lives. And what looks like a simple matter of going to work another day turns out to be a major event in Joseph's life. And may we be aware of the everyday situations you bring into our lives. May our responses be such that you can make us into the kind of people we need to be ready for what you want us to do. I pray that you would teach us. Open the eyes of our understanding, I pray, in your name. Amen. Joseph, at the end of chapter 39, verse 23, probably now enters the most trying time of his life. Say, what would be more trying than sold into slavery or put into prison? Well, life moves pretty quickly and is full of adrenaline for one who is just sold into slavery and transported over the wilderness down into Egypt, not knowing what would wait you at the auction block. I imagine that time passed very, very quickly. And it was a time full of suspense as Joseph faced a new life of servitude and of labor in the fields. And there was some respite, however, when he was elevated to a management position. And then that world came crashing down because of this false charge of attempted rape by Potiphar's wife. And then he's in prison, as we just read, and it seemed like the events were taking a more even keel. Again, he was placed in a management position and had a position of responsibility. And there seemed to be a ray of hope slicing through the darkness of that prison, that here was somebody he had helped and somebody who we assume had agreed that he would help bring Joseph out of that prison. And can you imagine what it was like for Joseph the next several days in that prison. Every time that gate opened and creaked open, Joseph probably ran around the corner to see if it was somebody who was going to release him. And yet it probably ended up being another prisoner brought in or a dead prisoner being taken out. And maybe he tried to justify in his mind, well, you know, the butler really hasn't had an audience with Pharaoh yet. And maybe it will come. And the days would wear on, and the gates would open and close, and there was no messenger asking for Joseph. And finally, it had to dawn on him at some point. He forgot. And Joseph has no idea how long he's going to be there. And you know, we don't know what Joseph's thoughts were and what went through his mind at that time, but I can imagine what might go through my mind at that a time like that. Things like this. How many times do I have to suffer for doing the right thing? Wasn't it enough that I just went out and checked on my brothers and obeyed Dad and I got sold into slavery? Isn't that enough? And isn't it enough that I try to do right and don't give in to that woman's seduction and I try to keep myself pure and I get thrown into prison for it? Isn't that enough? And isn't it enough that I sit here in prison and try to be a good testimony and try to help these people that are here and it looks like somebody would do me a favor, but they even forget? What is the use of doing right? I don't know if that went through his mind or not. Perhaps Joseph was more spiritual than I might be at a time like that. Why should we continue to do right indeed? So here Joseph is at the end of chapter 39 in prison for something he didn't do. And I want us to look once again at Joseph's responses. But I want us to ask ourselves, when we do right and suffer for it, what is our response? Do we respond with pride that we're handling things so well? Do we respond with anger and frustration that things are not going the way we want them to? Do we respond with despair that things never go the way I want them to? Do we respond with bitterness to the ones who stand in the way of our plans? Do we respond with worry that if things continue to go this way, we'll be ruined for sure? Do we respond with retaliation to those who have sabotaged our plans? Do we respond with manipulation to get what I want anyway? What is our response? I want to briefly cover three responses of Joseph that will kind of pull together all of these things he's been going through. Joseph's response was one of quiet sorrow through his disappointments, quiet obedience to every duty at hand, and quiet confidence that God is doing all things according to His plan. What I want us to see, folks, is that this is true Christian liberty. Joseph is free to respond in a right way. He's not drugged down by his own sin. He's not enslaved by the sins of other people against him, and he's not drugged down by the sins of the people around him. This is independence, folks. This is a person who can walk through this world independent of what is going on around him and not be affected by it. That's Christian liberty. You know what Christian liberty is? It's walking through a mall and not wanting anything. You're independent of that pull. It's facing a temptation and not giving in to it. That's Christian liberty. Freedom to be everything God made us to be. And God is wanting to make us into those kinds of people. This is stability. This is a wise man that's building his house on a rock. And when the winds blow and the rains descend and the floods come and the winds beat upon that house, it does not fall. That's stability. Well, let's look at these. Quiet sorrow. No complaint. Joseph responded with quiet sorrow. no complaint. Sorrow is the emotion of loss. When you lose something, there, God built into us in such a way that we actually feel that loss. And how much we feel it depends on how important that thing was to us. Obviously, we're going to feel differently about losing our car keys than if we do about losing a best friend or a parent or someone else in death that's close to us. And to the extent that that was important to us, we feel that. God intended. That's called sorrow. It's called grief. There's nothing sinful about it. It's only sinful. What becomes sinful is what we do in response to it. Joseph suffers with a quiet sorrow, with no complaint. He suffers without murmur to his father about how his brothers are treating him. He suffers without murmur to Potiphar about how his wife is seducing him. When he finally gets out and he stands before Pharaoh, he is not complaining about this crummy prison system around here and your legal system. There's no complaint. This is quiet sorrow. We need to ask ourselves, do we know anything about quiet sorrow? When things don't go right for us, do we hash and rehash them and go over them again and again in our minds and with our friends, and we blog about how this person has mistreated us and get everybody on board, and we call our friends and say, can you believe what so-and-so did to me and all that? This is not quiet sorrow. This is complaining sorrow. Well, it's so wrong what he did to me. What is just as wrong as how we're gossiping about what he did. We're not concerned about wrong, or we wouldn't be doing it. We're only concerned that somebody wronged us. These are not quiet sorrows with no complaint. These kinds of responses are an agitated sorrow that is filled with self-protectiveness and self-promotion. Godliness sorrows without complaint. Godliness sorrows without complaint. Godly sorrow doesn't have to tell everybody how bad my life is. Godly sorrow doesn't have to tell how wrong this person has been to me. Can you believe what he did? What would you do if he's this kind of thing? That's not quiet sorrow. Job had a quiet sorrow, didn't he? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I'm not going to charge God foolishly. There's no complaint. Secondly, there was a quiet obedience with no compromise. No matter what the pressure, Joseph would not disobey God. Joseph didn't stop doing with all his might whatever his hand found to do just because it was hard. There was no compromise in his service to Potiphar when he was purchased as a slave. There is no compromise in his obedience to Potiphar when he's put in this prison, falsely accused. And I want us to see a couple of very interesting things that come out of this prison situation right here. Obviously, Potiphar believed that Joseph was innocent. How do we know that? Joseph's still alive. I mean, Potiphar is the chief executioner of the country. And if that's your role and you keep your hatchet or whatever they used sharpened, and somebody tries to rape your wife, you do him in pretty quickly. Now, no doubt, he was angry. The scriptures say that Potiphar was angry when this happened. We don't know why he was angry. Whether he was angry that he's about to lose the best house steward he ever had, or whether he's angry that his wife has been at it again, or whether he is angry that maybe Joseph did do this, and he found out later he didn't. But nonetheless, and I can imagine him when he finally figures this out, saying to his wife, Mrs. Potiphar, I'll take care of that guy. You'll never see him again. And he puts him down in the prison to run the prison. Can you imagine this? I get a little carnal when I think about this. But can you imagine what must have been going through Mrs. Potiphar's mind when Joseph rides through the streets with all of this royalty, and now he's prime minister? I imagine that woman is probably thinking, I hope he doesn't remember who I am. You know, that was a Malox moment for sure for that woman. But now think about this. Potiphar knows that Joseph is innocent and will not do anything about it. Potiphar makes Joseph the fall guy. Joseph has to take the rap for something he didn't do. And then Potiphar turns around and says, by the way, would you do me a favor? Now I want to ask you, how do you and I respond when somebody tells us something to do and they're an authority in our life, but we don't think they've got their act together? How willing are we to obey them? Did you know that whether your authority has his act together or not should have no bearing on how well you obey? And Joseph understood that. There was a quiet obedience here with no compromise. He did not compromise what is right just because this guy doesn't have his act together. He could have said, you get somebody else to take care of your prisoners. I shouldn't be here in the first place. You think I'm going to do you a favor? Why don't you do me a favor and get me out of this hole? That is not his response. Godliness keeps doing right. It obeys God with no compromise. Quiet obedience. No compromise. Folks, we need to examine how obedient we are. And how, isn't it true that every time somebody asks us to do something, whether it's mom and dad or our employer or a school official, whatever, well, I saw him do this and I saw him do that. And she, what is she telling me that to do for? She's got her own problems. That should have no bearing on our obedience. Because it's God that commands the obedience. Jesus learned obedience by the things he suffered. Jesus made himself obedient to his authorities down here and he went to the cross. Quiet obedience, no compromise. And thirdly, a quiet confidence, no panic. A quiet confidence, no panic. What if Joseph had panicked and started fighting with his brothers when they started taking that coat off? What if he put up a scrap and fought and cursed and he's fighting and all this kind of thing? They probably would have killed him on the spot. They didn't need much reason to in their own minds. Well, Dad, you know, he attacked us. That was all we could do. You know, that's too bad. What if he'd been nasty and mean-spirited to those slave owners, slave traders as they went across that wilderness? What if he'd put up a stink with them all the time and been real difficult to get along with? They probably would have found a reason to kill him, too. What if Joseph had gone postal in prison? I mean, here he is confined in enclosed spaces and he's got shackles on his hands and he's got a shackle on his neck. What if he'd gone ballistic and gone postal, as we say, lost it, panicked? He probably would have been beaten to death. I want you to notice his response when he comes to work. Would you look at verse 6, chapter 40? I want us to see his quiet confidence here. This is an amazing thing to me in verses 6 and 7. And Joseph came in unto them in the morning and looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. Look how this man comes to work. Here somebody comes into your office where you work, and they're just all bent out of shape, and they left the house late, and they forgot something, they had to go back, and they're coming, and they're telling you all this, they come in the door, they're 20 minutes late, they say, I can't believe this, you know, I had all this problem, and he goes through the whole thing, and this is, and I get down here to the corner, and I need that left turn signal to make it here on time, and there's some woman sitting in the car in front of me, and she's talking on her cell phone, misses the green arrow, we gotta go through that whole cycle again, if people can't drive it, they had to park it! You know, and on like that. Now I want to ask you a question. Do you think a person who comes to work like that is noticing the discouragement on anybody else's face? No. Folks, you will never have any ministry with anybody when you're obsessed with your own misery. Joseph has a quiet confidence that God is working out a plan and this is all okay and he's given me work to do and part of that is attending to the needs of these people and look at that. What, that guy's, he's sad. I need to talk to him. Look how this guy comes to work. Notice his response to the dreams. Verse 8. And by the way, I think that last incident there of how he comes to work is one of the greatest evidences of a quiet confidence. No matter what is crushing down on top of him, this man is so free from self-centeredness that he can pick up on the needs of other people around him just by looking at their face. It's amazing testimony. But look at his response to dreams. Another way that shows his confidence here in God, a quiet confidence. Verse 8, and they said unto him, we've dreamed a dream, and there's no interpreter of it. And Joseph said unto them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me them, I pray thee. These men were, this butler, chief butler, and this chief baker, the chief butler here actually is a chief cupbearer, very much like Nehemiah, probably. Testing the food to be sure there's nothing that is going to be dangerous to the king. And apparently, we don't exactly know, but apparently there was someone who had tried to do something against the life of Pharaoh, and it had something to do with food, it seems like, and Pharaoh puts the top two guys in prison till that's ironed out. The chief butler and the chief baker. And so here they are in prison. And Pharaoh has a birthday, and we don't know if this is an amnesty for general amnesty for prisoners or if they somehow found out who really was guilty and who was not. And it seems like that's probably what happened because one of them was killed. You don't do that for your birthday party. And one of them is killed and one of them is not. But what I want you to see is Joseph's willingness to interpret their dreams. Now, why is that so impressive? Because how are his dreams coming out? He could have said, oh, y'all had dreams? I had some dreams. Let's talk about dreams, all right? Sheaves bowing, sun and moon bowing. Does it look like that's happening, folks? Does that look like dreams? Oh, listen, don't pay any attention to dreams. Joseph could have been a cynic. But he's not. Joseph has a quiet confidence. And the fact that Joseph comes along and says, God works through dreams, tells me that Joseph knew God was going to come through on his dream too. I want you to notice another response here in prison, verses 18 and 19. I want you to notice how he delivers. Notice his response when he has to confront somebody with bad news. And I'm telling you, folks, this was bad news. Not just that this guy was going to die. But Joseph said, here's how you're going to die. Pharaoh's going to remove your head from you. I don't know Hebrew, so I don't know if this parallel is in the Hebrew or not. But in the King James here, it says of the butler, he said, yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up thine head and restore thee. And this time he says he's going to lift up your head from off thee. I don't know if there's probably not a humorous parallel there that Joseph is making. But this guy is going to be beheaded and then hung on a tree for the birds of the air to destroy his body. Now, that is about the worst thing that could ever happen to an Egyptian. They embalmed bodies so that the body could be preserved so that in the next life you would have something to live in. So if you and then he's not going to get an embalming job. He's going to have no body for the next life. He's not going to have a next life. This is pretty bad news. It's easy for any of us, is it not, to deliver good news to people? It takes some quiet confidence in God to deliver bad news. And Joseph has that quiet confidence. Listen, it takes a quiet confidence to speak the difficult things to people, whether they be your own teenagers you must speak with, or a coworker, or a student in your class, or a friend. But a godly person has a quiet confidence in God that will allow him to tell people the things they need to hear. The people who have no confidence in God run from those responsibilities. They don't mind delivering good news, but they don't want to deliver bad news. Joseph delivers bad news. And I imagine Joseph gave this man what was a Hebrew version of God's simple plan of salvation, knowing Joseph. Joseph's responses are godly. They reveal a quiet confidence. There's no panic. There's no shirking of responsibility. There is no cynicism. And one last thing, I want you to notice his response to the white spaces. Say, white spaces. Well, look at chapter 40 at the end, verse 23. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. Then there's a white space, isn't there, between that and the next verse in chapter 41. And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years. The white space is the time we have to wait while God works out his plan. And we know Joseph had a right response to that 2 years, because when he finally got out before Pharaoh, which we'll look at next week, he's not complaining to Pharaoh and all this kind of, you see a quiet confidence through this man. Well, how can Joseph respond with quiet sorrow, no complaint, quiet obedience, no compromise, and quiet confidence, no panic? What guides his responses? And I want us to look at one thing. Joseph sees God in the picture. Look at verse 8. Do not interpretations belong to God? Would you turn over to chapter 41? We won't get there till next week, but he eventually, as you know, is brought out of prison and interprets Pharaoh's dreams. And look, I want you to notice how this man talks about God. Look in verse 16. And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, this is chapter 41, verse 16. It is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Verse 25. And Joseph said unto Pharaoh, the dream of Pharaoh is one. God has showed Pharaoh what he is about to do. Verse 28. This is a thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he showeth unto Pharaoh. Verse 32, and for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. This man doesn't hesitate to talk about God, even in front of Pharaoh. In fact, look at this influence on this that this man has on Pharaoh. Verse 37, and the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, can we find such a one as this is, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, for as much as God has showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise. He's got Pharaoh talking about God. That's influence, folks. You don't get other people talking about God if you don't talk about God. The thing that was front and center with Joseph was that there's a God in heaven and he has spoken. And I don't know how he's doing it or when he's going to do it or how it's going to come out, but he will do what he promised. And he could be quiet in all of his responses. And we get to chapter 50, verse 20, which is the Romans 8:28 of the Old Testament, where Joseph said, you intended this. He's talking to his brothers. You intended this for evil, but God intended this for good. That's why this man's stable. He sees God in everything. Well, how do you get that kind of awareness of God? Some of you heard me use this illustration before. My dad was a mechanic. He's with the Lord now, but Dad could fix anything. He'd worked on everything from locomotives to sewing machines, and his philosophy was if a man made it, a man ought to be able to fix it. And if you had an appliance in your house that my dad couldn't fix, you just need to junk it because it can't be fixed. And Dad had quadruple bypass surgery. He had the same problem that I have with abnormally small arteries. And he had quadruple bypass. And he had to quit doing a lot of the heavy work he was doing, and he took up locksmithing because he could still use that keen mechanical mind and didn't have to do all the heavy lifting and all that kind of thing. You know, if Dad were sitting in this audience tonight and you were to say to him, Mr. Berg, what kind of locks are on this church and these doors you came in? My dad could tell you like that what kind of locks were in this church. How many of you know what kind of locks are in this church? One over here. Anybody else know? How did you get in? Didn't you come through a door? You see, you don't have any awareness of locks. And honestly, I don't either. I probably have a little more than you might because of hanging around my dad. But I don't have much awareness either. Why is it we have no awareness of locks? Because we don't spend any time studying locks. We'd go over to my dad's house. Mom and dad, they would have us over every Thursday night. My brother and his family would be there and our family would be there. And we'd come over there. Dad would be sitting in the recliner studying a locksmithing journal. Or he'd be out in his mobile locksmithing van recombinating a lock or practicing picking a lock or something, and he'd just be out there working on locks. He'd spend every quarter, he'd go down to Columbia Friday night and Saturday to a locksmithing convention, find out what new things were out and how do they handle this thing and what kind of new keys do the cars have and all that kind of... He spent all his time with locks. So he was aware of locks. Why do some people see God in every situation and some people never see Him at all? Because some people spend a lot of time studying God and some people don't. Joseph spent a lot of time thinking about his God. He didn't have a Bible like you and I do. If you don't spend hours a week in your Bible, and I'm not trying to give you some legalistic thing, but you don't become godly on a drive-by devotional or reading one page out of our daily crumb. That's not a bad start. That's a granola bar, but that is no meal and you don't survive on that. You spend hours a week in your Bible begging God to open your eyes and show you how He works and what He is like. And you come into a situation in life and say, wow, this is just like this one over here that Paul had. And this is just like this one that Timothy faced. And this is just like this one that Daniel had. And this is just like what David did in this thing. And you recognize God in the picture. But if you don't do that, folks, you will have no awareness of God. Most of us don't even notice any locks on the door until we can't get in it and then we just beat on it. And a lot of us don't notice God in the situations and all we do is just bang on the door and beat people up and cuss at it. In a Christian way, of course. Complaining. This is an amazing man because he lived with an awareness of an amazing God. And that will make the difference in your responses and my response. The test of every response is, do you see God in this picture? And if you do, you will respond to these setbacks with quiet sorrow that things have not turned out well yet. In quiet obedience, you will do the will of God anyway. In quiet confidence, there will be no panic. I grew up in South Dakota where it's winter, 9 months out of the year, I think. It would snow on we'd trick-or-treat in snow most of the years and hope it'd go away by Easter, and it'd get 20 below, and it'd stay 20 below for weeks on end. Just brutal cold. Well, we grew up out in the country, and we had a creek. We called it a crick, Skunk Crick. That was the name of it. It was about 20 feet wide and about 4 to 10 feet deep in different places. But in the wintertime, it would freeze all the way to the bottom. And when I was a little boy, 4th, 5th, 6th grade, we loved coming home from school. We would grab a shovel and our skates and head for the creek. And we would shovel off all of the snow that had drifted over the top of that, and we would skate until it got dark. And we'd come home and eat and do the same thing the next day. I love skating. I haven't done ice skating for a long time. Not a lot of ice in South Carolina. Thankfully, I've had all I want. But you know, for that reason, the Winter Olympics have always had a big appeal to me watching that figure skating. Now, I will never do a triple axel. I wouldn't even ever try a triple axel. I wouldn't try most of what they do there. I love that because there's something about watching something done really well that kind of stirs something in you where you say, I want to be like that. Now, the problem with the Olympics is then they started doing all that rock music that they did. So then you have to turn off the sound and then they come out without hardly any clothes on. You have to turn off the video. So you just kind of sit there and watch that blank screen and it's just not any fun anymore. But every time I saw that, I would say, boy, I wish I could do that. When I look at this story of Joseph, I say, this is what I want to be like. When I'm mistreated, this is the way I want to respond. When somebody maligns me and falsely accuses me, this is the way I want to handle it. When I get charged with somebody else's sin, this is the way I want to do it. If I get forgotten, this is the way I want to handle it. Folks, this is Olympian Christianity. And it's all measured by your responses. Dr. Bob Sr. used to say, the crisis does not make the man. It reveals what he is. Let's bow our heads. Father, this is entirely possible because we have right here inspired examples of men and women in this book who live right under intense persecution and suffering. And we know, therefore, it can be our legacy as well. If we would know you as they know you, help us to that end.